And welcome back to your extended news at noon. Tracy Morgan, of course, with you. On the phone with me is Dr. David Rodinghouse. Now, we've had Dr. Rodinghouse from the hospital on many times, a chief medical officer, VP of medical affairs, emergency medicine as well. So first of all, welcome, Dr. Rodinghouse. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
I wanted to have you on today, and we asked a couple of days ago, so we were trying to get our schedules together. So again, I appreciate your time today. But when I asked you to be on, I wanted to talk about the different symptoms between just having a regular cold and the flu and COVID and when do we get a test. So we will get to that. And I want to make sure that I do ask you all of that because that is still the bulk of my interest this morning. But when I asked you to be on the show today, we both know that the news about the president had not broken yet. And so since we are where we are today, I'm not going to have you on per se to talk about the president. I know you're not his doctor, so we can't really ask those kinds of questions. But I do have a couple of questions that I heard being talked about over the weekend. And so I'm wondering if you would take a moment and talk to us about the testing and then how long we should isolate after a COVID diagnosis. So let me start with the testing, if you don't mind, because there was a lot of verbiage being thrown out there. It had to do with the PCR, the antigen test, the antibody test. And I thought, okay, can you please explain what those are and what is the best test for anyone to get to detect COVID?
Sure. That's a question that we've been struggling with, you know, since really coronavirus was introduced to humanity several months ago. The testing has been difficult, and it's layered with issues depending on what type of test, you know, somebody gets. So let's start with the PCR, because that was really the first test that became available. So PCR is what's called a molecular test or a polymerase chain reaction. So the acronym is not as important as understanding what the test means. So what it does is it detects fragments of the virus. And this test began to be developed very early on once companies and once the CDC and other countries knew the genetic sequence of the virus, which was released, I think, on January 11th, you know, to the world once the virus was identified. So what this test does is through, you know, various mechanisms of, you know, splitting apart the virus and detecting fragments of the virus, it tells you if you have the virus in your system. And most of them are nasal swabs. That's how they were developed. So a swab up the nose. It can be a very uncomfortable test and be a deep nasal swab, depending on, you know, who the manufacturer is and how they recommend obtaining the swab. This also can be a sputum-induced swab where you know, cough and produce sputum and spit it into a tube. But no matter how it's collected, this test is probably the best test that we have in terms of detecting the virus. So, you know, better than the rapid test, better than the rapid antigen test, which we'll talk about next. But the problem with this PCR testing is that although it's very good at detecting the virus, it can detect the virus for a long time. So we began to learn early on that some people will shed or, you know, have this virus detectable in their nose, in their throat, even in their lungs for long periods of time, meaning weeks, or even in some cases, months. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they're still infected with the virus. It also did not mean that they could necessarily give the virus to somebody else. In other words, they weren't infectious or contagious, but the virus just hung around for a long period of time and was detectable and still remains detectable by this test. So as testing was being developed, and there are other tests, you know, hopefully on the very near horizon, aside from the three we'll talk about, but it led to development of the rapid antigen test. And what that test is, it's similar to the rapid flu tests that we have nowadays that detect flu A and flu B, you know, the two most common strains of influenza. And that test has some caveats to it. So it's not as accurate as the PCR test overall, and it really has a sweet spot where you want to test somebody with a rapid antigen, and that is within the first several days and up to 5 days of when they develop symptoms, and you know, usually correlated with an exposure. So it's a test that's limited by time. It's also limited by its accuracy, and has other sort of scientific limitations to it that, go into math and probability and sensitivity and specificity. But the important thing for people to know is that test is really only useful in people who have symptoms and who have symptoms within a shortened period of time, because their body will produce this antigen that is detected, again, typically by a nasal swab, typically not as uncomfortable as the PCR, but it has to be within a very short period of time. So that has a very limited time frame. And then we'll talk about as well right now the antibody test. So early on, when countries were experiencing, large surges of the virus, and we had difficulty detecting the virus, the antibody test was seen as potentially one that, if you were positive, maybe, really was understood as immunity to the virus. So you were already exposed, you were already, you already overcame the virus, and within a couple weeks of recovering from the virus, you could detect antibodies. So antibodies are our own natural defense. Our body produces antibodies to fight off all kind of different infections and processes. And it was felt that if you detected those antibodies, then you overcame coronavirus and you were probably immune. So the idea of immunity passports and introducing people back into society and back into work when we were more locked down became an idea. There's some debate over whether or not people can become infected with coronavirus again. There are cases out there. And hopefully and likely it is true that if you become infected with coronavirus after an initial infection, then either you're going to have no symptoms or very minimal symptoms. That hasn't been proven yet, but that's the hope given, some cases where people have had the virus twice. The limitation with that is the virus has only been around for a limited amount of time. It's been less than a year, and the opportunity for people to become infected more than once, therefore, is not so high. So antibody testing can be used after people recover or to screen to see if people have been exposed, but the utility of it and how we manage that and how people go back about their lives is much in debate. I'm sorry it's a long-winded answer.
No,
we could talk about testing all day long.
Right.
There's a lot of wrinkles to it.
And so if I hear you right, then the first two that you talked about, the PCR and the antigen test, are the tests to see if you have COVID, where the antibody test is that you've recovered, you have the antibodies in your system.
Correct.
Okay.
Been exposed before.
So the first two, again, are the nasal swabs. That antibody test is a blood test. So let me go back to the first two. I've had people tell me they've had that uncomfortable test, the PCR, going way up the nose. And then I know people who said I had to get tested for work. My test came in the mail. I just had to go get the very tip of my nose, and I sent my test back. How is that different? I mean, where do you have to get the fluid from within your body, in the nasal cavity, in order to get a proper test?
Another great question. So the accuracy of some of these tests also depends on the quality of the sample. So the better the sample, which usually means a sample deeper within the nose, will usually give you a more accurate test. But it also depends on the manufacturer, how the test is run. And although it would seem to be the same exact test because they're using the same technology, the sampling of that specimen and how the test was approved and how the test was researched and created also is different from manufacturer to manufacturer. And there are literally hundreds of companies now running COVID testing. Even though it may all be PCR, the manner in which they conduct that testing and how the sample is obtained can be different.
Remind us where we are right now. If we think that we need a COVID test, there are places we can just go ahead and sign up and go get the test, or can we also get the doctor's order? Where are we right now in this?
Yeah, so most places you can stop in and get a test. I know a lot of the urgent cares, even the retail testing has taken off in some of the retail pharmacies. I know a lot of the big store chains, such as Walmart and others, either have implemented in certain areas or are implementing. We still have two drive-through locations where people sit in their cars and get a test. It doesn't, we prefer to have a script or an order from a physician, but we've, you know, found workarounds if people show up without a prescription and have, you know, a reason to get a test. So there's a lot of places to get testing. It's very easy to find them, you know, through an online search or, you know, whatever search engine you prefer. The best way to go about antigen testing, though, the fast test, is only for people who are symptomatic. So the antigen test is probably a little more difficult to find than the PCR, but the appropriate use of these tests should be really best guided under direction of their, you know, primary care physician or, you know, whatever other healthcare worker is helping these folks to get tested for the right reasons.
So if we want to go get a test, if we think we need a test, and let's say we don't have the doctor's script to do that, what do we need to ask? Well, even if we have the doctor's script, but I mean, if we're going through the line of the hospital, I know you all know exactly what to offer us in the way of a test. Should we ask for a PCR versus an antigen, or how do we know what we need in the moment? Because I'm not saying that people aren't intelligent, but if I'm walking in, I have no idea what I'm asking for.
Right. So that is best coordinated with a trusted healthcare provider, either a primary care physician or, you know, another healthcare worker who can help guide that testing, you know, whether it's from, you know, an urgent care, another clinic, you know, whomever people would typically seek, you know, for healthcare advice or for healthcare treatment. And the reason is because of those caveats we discussed in both, you know, rapid antigen and PCR testing. So if I don't have symptoms and I don't have a known exposure, the antigen test really shouldn't be run on me. The antigen test should be reserved for people who believe or have a plausible reason to think that they've been infected with the coronavirus within a very short period of time. So knowing the nuances of those tests, it means it's best guided or assisted with, you know, your physician or healthcare provider.
Dr. David Rottinghaus with us this afternoon, Chief Medical Officer, Vice President of Medical Affairs, Emergency Medicine, of course, at the Butler Health System. The last question is going to lead us into what I wanted to talk to you about today, the bulk of this information, even though I appreciate your time that you've spent with us already. When we're in flu season, when we're in that typical cold season, and now we have COVID on top of that, what are the differences in the symptoms? What are the similarities in the symptoms? And the reason I say that is because now that kids are back to school, we parents know that colds are going to come our way, right? I mean, in any other typical year, we know the colds are going to come. Now, we see some kids sniffling and sneezing and coughing. Maybe the teachers are sniffling, sneezing, and coughing. Maybe the parents get it at that point. Do we run and get a COVID test, or how do we know when it's time to go get a COVID test?
So that's an excellent question. And your points about kids not, you know, sneezing, coughing is spot on. So, you know, as winter settles in, as flu season and other, you know, cold, you know, symptoms set in, as the temperature gets colder, the humidity drops, it becomes easier to transmit respiratory viruses, such as the common cold, such as flu and a host of other things, and, you know, theoretically, such as coronavirus. So, you know, we're gathering people back together. We're putting them in classrooms and other areas where there may be a lot of people around. So, it becomes very easy to transmit. And as, you know, probably most people have read, the symptoms of COVID-19 are all over the map. So, you know, they may have no symptoms, which tends to be more common in kids, a runny nose, a mild cough, a mild sore throat, or, you know, some of the more severe symptoms of, you know, pneumonia, shortness of breath, and the other consequences that we know can happen with COVID-19. So the answer to the question, how do you distinguish, you know, the common cold from flu from COVID-19, is you really can't without testing. So the one symptom that really seems to stand out with COVID-19, if you get loss of taste or, you know, smell, then that at this point in time would very strongly suggest and almost certainly suggest the diagnosis of COVID-19.
Now, that alone, is that with congestion or not? And I ask that seriously because, again, I recently saw a young person sniffling, sneezing, and I thought, well, if they're sniffling, sneezing, and they're congested, they're not going to be able to smell or taste anyway. So when you make that statement that a loss of taste or smell is a very good indicator, not a positive result, but a good indicator that you might want to get a test of COVID, is that with or without congestion?
Typically going to be with congestion, but nothing's 100%. They may have those symptoms without a lot of congestion, without a lot of cough. So, again, there's no slam dunk or easy answer to the question, but most likely they're going to have symptoms of an upper respiratory infection, which are the symptoms you mentioned, stuffy nose, cough, congestion. But complete loss of taste and sensation, people may get a more diminished with the common cold or other respiratory illnesses. But COVID-19 seems to have a pretty profound effect on taste and smell, more so than usually just kind of that typical sinus infection or congestion.
So I wouldn't smell like the mentholated drops that I'm trying to suck on as a lozenge. You probably just wouldn't even smell any of that is what I'm understanding.
Well, not having had those symptoms, I understand that the loss is pretty significant.
Okay.
And, people have a difficult time tasting or smelling anything.
Okay.
So I haven't been through it, but I understand that the loss is pretty profound.
Okay. All right. So that's a good indicator to go ahead and get a test. Let me ask you a couple other questions and I'll let you go. I know you're busy and you have some work to do today. Let me ask you about the waves. Again, I asked Dr. Love this a few months ago and I'm still trying to understand the waves. Are we going to be in a second wave or did we already have a second wave? I mean, and why are you expecting a wave as we get into the fall?
Well, people I think are trying to compare it to influenza. So the initial wave, so to speak, of this virus, spreading around the world happened because, there was no great way to initially test for the virus. People had a variety of symptoms, and the virus being brand new, nobody really knew exactly what to expect. So we've gained an incredible amount of knowledge, but the fact that no human being has ever had this virus, so no human being had inherent immunity or any way to really have their immune system be automatically triggered to fight it, meant that it was easy to spread. In other words, it could be given to essentially everyone. So the initial wave was really this virus spreading as expected through a population that had no way of naturally fighting it off. So the waves themselves, I think the way we really need to think about this is this virus will be around until we develop, the term that's being thrown around is herd immunity. And the best way to do that is through a vaccine where we protect people, we give their immune system a way to fight off this virus should they become exposed in the future, just as we do, with a host of other viruses that we've eradicated, measles, mumps, rubella, polio, et cetera. So a safe vaccine and a widely available vaccine will be the ultimate solution to this. But I think we need to think about this not so much in terms of trying to compare it to flu, where there's definitely seasonality. And as the temperature drops and as the humidity drops and as people gather together and inside more often, the influenza virus is spread more easily. And it's believed that the flu virus is also susceptible and dies quicker in heat and in humidity. Coronavirus, because of its exposure, to humans as a new virus, think about the waves as any loosening we do in terms of restrictions to get people together and to have people in crowds, especially when they're not practicing social distancing, wearing masks, and diligently washing their hands, it's going to lead to spread of the virus. So, of course, there's a balance between, opening the economy, getting people back to work, getting, things up and moving, getting people back in school. But any time we have relaxing of those restrictions and of, people not practicing, those simple principles to fight an infectious disease, especially a respiratory disease, we're going to see increased spread and we're going to see increased number of cases. So it's a balance. Getting people back and working and out in the community and, doing things that are normal in life. But we do know that those waves will occur the more we allow people to congregate, gather, and the less compliance there is with recommendations when people do go out and when people get together.
Let me take you back in history a little bit. I was trying to read a little bit about the 1918 flu pandemic, and in one article I read, the way they put it, not verbatim, was basically that the pandemic just left and nobody could understand how it just left. A whole nother article that I read talked about how it morphed into just another seasonal flu. So it appeared to go away, but actually what we battle now kind of has some descendants from 1918. What is your opinion on that? Back in history, what happened, and how do we know today that it just doesn't go away? I mean, how is it that you say this won't go away until we have a vaccine?
Well, it won't go away because the virus, again, is new to mankind. It's in terms of it just going away, it is not going to completely go away. I mean, this virus is going to linger around, and the nature of the virus and spread to a pandemic level, which didn't happen with SARS-CoV-1, which was well over a decade ago, and became contained. The nature of this virus is such that viruses have different qualities to them. They can either be very transmissible, in other words, go from human to human. And it usually balances that with how severe a disease and how fatal it may be. So this virus appears to be, highly contagious by the way it's spread around the world and the number of cases that we know about. So it's not just going to go away because of the highly contagious nature of it. Now, when you go back and look at the, 1918 flu pandemic, and, certainly I wasn't alive back then, but the history of it was such that, obviously there was different medical care at the time. There was a different level of understanding. And, the scientific ability to test for that virus and to, to isolate and to treat doesn't compare to today. So the advance in therapeutics, and you see that with the president, the different medications, the different treatment that's used, has really grown incredibly over the last, 9-10 months. But what it appeared to happen with that pandemic was seasonality. So, anytime people were gathered together, and there's, a lot of cases out of just the United States Army and where our Army was camped, the seasonal peaks that occurred, really spread rapidly, through those different members of the military, and unfortunately caused the tremendous burdens of illness and a lot of death. Probably a lot of that death could have been avoided by medical practices today and, some of the standards that we have today to just mitigate spread of the virus. But what appeared to happen was seasonality. And the difference it looks like with COVID-19 versus influenza is COVID doesn't appear to have seasonality associated with it. If it did, then the cases, throughout the summer really would have substantially dropped. But again, what we see is anytime there's congregation, there's crowds getting together, and the Rose Garden event is a good example of that.
Yeah.
We're not quite in flu season yet. You gather people together, you have one positive or a couple positives, and it easily spreads to other people. So I think that's going to be the ultimate big difference between the lack of seasonality with coronavirus versus the seasonality of flu viruses.
Last question, and this, of course, has been a topic of conversation, especially with yesterday with the president making a trip out of the hospital, if you will. He was wearing a mask, and I'm not going to ask if you agree with that or not, or if you can offer whatever thoughts you'd like. But my question that I'd like to ask you is, for anyone who is diagnosed with COVID, how long should we isolate after that diagnosis?
Sure. So good question. And this has, changed frequently, throughout the course of the last several months. So if you are diagnosed with COVID-19, the minimum isolation is 10 days. The caveat to that is you have to be at least 10 days from the diagnosis and 24 hours without any symptoms, no cough, no cold, no flu, no body ache. So you should have full recovery of those symptoms before you go back out. And then for an exposure, the recommended isolation is 14 days. And the reason for that is, if I am diagnosed with COVID-19 and, you know, my neighbor is over and they've been in close contact and they haven't, you know, practiced the appropriate social distancing, then their infection may set in after, you know, several days, at least up to 14 days. So that's the reason for the 2 weeks for that person. So it seems, you know, confusing that somebody who's diagnosed with COVID-19 has a shorter duration of quarantine or isolation. But in fact, that accounts for, you know, the exposure to be isolated for 14 days, just because it may take a few days for that infection to set in and to start to show symptoms. And the CDC recommends 14 days. So, you know, I think those are important because until we break the cycle of transmission and I stop giving it to other people, then, you know, I will continue to spread it if I am positive and I don't appropriately quarantine or isolate myself and protect other citizens from getting the virus.
Dr. David Rodinghouse, Chief Medical Officer, Vice President of Medical Affairs and Emergency Medicine at the Butler Health System. As always, we appreciate the Butler Health System's time and especially your time today, Dr. Rodinghouse. Thank you very much for being here.
Hey, thank you very much. And we appreciate the community support throughout this time as a health system. And, you know, thanks for having me on this morning.